If you enjoy this podcast, please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at lifebetweenthevines.com.
There's a historical kind of aspect to Merlot here at Sullivan, Jim Sullivan, when he purchased the property in the late 70s and planted really in 1978. You know, at that time, you know, Napa, I think, was still kind of figuring out what grows best and where. The Cabernet craze hadn't really taken off at that point. So he had Zinfandel, Merlot, Cabernet, Chenin Blanc, Chardonnay planted all across the property. And what he found was that obviously the Bordeaux varieties did well, but Merlot specifically was outstanding here.
Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 591. This week we feature Jeff Cole, winemaker at Sullivan Rutherford Estate, Napa Valley. Any winemaker will tell you that wine is made in the vineyard. But the role of a winemaker can never be underestimated. Focus, experience, talent are just some of the major ingredients in making great wine. Jeff Cole, winemaker at Sullivan Rutherford Estate in Napa Valley, is our guest today. And I interviewed Jeff by phone way back in June of 2020. At that time, all of our interviews were done by phone due to COVID. This time, we meet at the estate and talk wine face to face, while the Napa winter drops precious rain from a beautiful rainbow. You can also hear Jeff on our Vino Lingo segment defining the term unicorn team.
It's really great to finally meet people in person who you've interviewed via the phone during COVID, which we did a lot of that. I'm here with Jeff Cole. Jeff is a winemaker at Sullivan Rutherford Estate in Napa Valley. Jeff, how are you?
I'm doing well, Ray. How are you doing?
I'm great. Good to be here. A little bit of rain going on here.
Just a little bit. You know, the last couple of years, it's been a good reprieve having some moisture hit the ground, kind of replenish the aquifers, obviously revitalize the soil, if you will. So, yeah, I'm not mad at it.
Yeah, I know. It's got to make you real happy, if anything, because, you know, you guys wear drought on your shoulders.
We definitely wear a drought on our shoulders, and that presents problems in and of itself, but you know, I like to say, maybe this isn't great for ownership, but I like drought years. Lower yields, more concentration in the wines. Obviously, you make a little bit of less wine, but I think overall, from a quality standpoint, it's okay. But, you know, obviously, we can't go years and years without having the aquifers and just water replenished within the system. So once in a while, you know, I'll give way and allow a little bit of rain and be happy about it.
Yeah, it's good to allow that. Well, of course, when it comes to things like fires, that sort of thing, it's good to have that rain happening. Yeah. And I believe it was a week or two ago, there was the incredible the river that came in from the coast that, was it a lot worse, I'm assuming?
The bomb cyclone. I feel like the last couple of years when we've gotten those reports, there's this lead up to this huge weather event, you know, it kind of falls short a little bit. And I feel like a couple of weeks ago, we were kind of in that same boat. Granted, there was plenty of wind, plenty of trees fell, homes within my neighborhood were affected by it. Fortunately for me, I wasn't, but there was an impact. But as far as, you know, that torrential rain that just kind of kept coming, you know, it wasn't to that extreme, but again, it was definitely wet.
Yeah, and after not having it for so long, I mean, there's got to be a certain amount of security that comes from it.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, as much as we want, you know, well-drained soils and we want low moisture during the growing season, I mean, water is important to life and important for the health of the vines. And, you know, saturating the ground allows the vines to pull the nutrients out and really, you know, establish themselves for the upcoming year. So, again, yeah, I mean, rain is welcome. I mean, then it gets to a point where it's not welcome anymore. And so we're kind of getting there. And hopefully, as we finish out February, you know, things starting to lighten up a little bit and we can, you know, the vines will be coming out of dormancy and preparing to produce grapes for the upcoming vintage. And at that point, we We need the rain to stop.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm going to come back to that in just 1 minute, but I believe I'm allowed to use this term. You are officially a napkin, correct?
I am, yes.
Okay. I don't know if you guys get offended by that term or what.
I mean, I grew up in Yountville, so I guess technically I'm a Yountvillian.
Oh, Yountvillian. You don't even want to write that out, do you?
That's
but still, to grow up in a place like this would be mind-blowing. I mean, you must have had a really great time living here when you were a kid.
Yeah, yes. I mean, I think I grew up in, I was kind of one of the I would say the last generation, at least, you know, in the Yountville area, before really the popularity of Napa and just the tourism and how, you know, the cities and towns really kind of catered towards, you know, folks coming in to enjoy this beautiful valley, and which is great for business and it's great for what I do for a living. But as far as being a local and the communities around us and the people that have been here for a while, you know, it drives the prices up, things get more expensive, and you know, it kind of pushes people out in a sense. And so, yeah, growing up in Yountville in the 80s and 90s, it's a small town. It's, you know, less than 2 miles long and less than a mile wide, and there were plenty of kids and neighborhoods and families. And so being able to really rip around the town freely, I mean, we didn't lock our doors at night, we left the keys in our cars, we stayed out all night. I mean, there were no threats, and so it was an ideal for me place to grow up, because I could be a kid and there was plenty of kids to be a kid with. Whereas, you know, now I've got two 11-year-old daughters, and it's a different place, and there is, you know, less young, you know, there's less of the younger generation. And so now it's, you've got to drive to go have play dates, and there aren't kids up and down the streets. And so in that aspect, you know, there has been a pretty big change within kind of the community and the culture of the valley. But again, it's for a reason. And, you know, my profession is making wine, and, you know, making wine is great, but if you can't sell it, it doesn't really matter. And so by catering towards the people coming in looking for the food and the wine and all those experiences, I mean, I think it's been a great thing for the industry.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Have you, did you get to spend a lot of time wandering around up in the mountains?
In which mountains?
Any of them? All of them?
All of them. No, I mean, you know, until I was of age to drive, really it was just hanging out within Yountville, and playing sports was a big thing, you know. Napa, playing up in St. Helena. Not too much in terms of spending time in the mountains.
Just like the vineyards that you'll find up in the mountains, I think what's fascinating about them for someone like me, and I'm a city boy,
yeah,
is the secrets they keep. Because you drive around and you'll find a huge vineyard that you can't see from
right
down here. Or there's obviously critters wandering around, or just in general roads that are completely invisible. They have their secrets up there.
They do. And I think, you know, people are realizing that. And as much as there is the wildlife and there is, you know, the secrets being held, there's a lot of high-quality vineyards coming off the mountainsides, and people are recognizing that. And now it's hard to build a vineyard on a mountain because of the people that have kind of come before us, and now that there are standards in place. Because again, you know, 20 years ago it was kind of the wild, wild west up there. You find a spot, you clear it out. You know, there wasn't maybe as much attention focused on erosion control, and so there was a lot of issues over the last, you know, 20, 30 years that have come up because of these vineyards planted, because that is where, you know, high quality is coming from, and not the only place it's coming from, but you know, being up in on the hillsides with slope and aspect and drainage, you get lower yields and higher concentration in your wines, and that's what people are looking for. So they're going up into the hills. And so, yeah, 20 or 30 years ago, it was kind of a free-for-all. Now, a little more difficult, a lot more regulation in place to manage that. And so, yeah, I mean, if anybody's looking for a vineyard, you can't really plant it, so you have to buy it. But because those vineyards are in such high demand, they become very expensive.
Oh, I can't even imagine.
Yeah.
So obviously you are Rutherford Estate. We've already established that.
Yep.
And is everything valley floor, or do you have some vineyards in the hills?
Yeah, so the original property here at Sullivan Rutherford Estate is 26 acres, 22 of which are planted. And again, we're really right in the middle of the valley. In fact, the property line toward north, so going up towards St. Helena, is what's known as the Rancho Camas line. And that really delineates historically the valley into two parcels. You have Rancho Camas to the south and Rancho Carne Humana to the north. And that was done in the early 1800s when Mexico owned this portion of California and decided to split the valley into two parcels. And it's kind of funny, the story goes, or lore goes, is the government put a person on a horse down in Napa or southern part of the valley, and then a person on a horse in the northern part of the valley. And wherever they met is where they delineated the two ranchos. And that happens to be, you know, the bordering line to our northern part of the property here. So in reality, we are in the center of the Napa Valley, and we are on the valley floor. In the last 5 years, we've brought in two more sites within the estate. We have a property, it's off Soda Canyon Road, so it's southern part of the valley to the east. I call it the foothills of Atlas Peak. It's not quite an Atlas Peak AVA. It really borders Coombsville and Atlas Peak. It's kind of no man's land, but really an up-and-coming spot as far as, you know, kind of to your point, you know, the relatively unknown until the last, you know, 5 to 10 years. And now that area is kind of a hot spot for people, you know, going, acquiring land, buying grapes, making wine. And what's unique about that area is that we're not quite in the hills, but again, the foothills, so kind of rolling, a little bit of elevation, but very volcanic soils down there, a lot of the white ash, rhyolitic type material. And then because we are a little bit farther south, we still get a coastal influence. So at night, the breeze picks up, it cools down, so you get the warm days and the cool nights, which, you know, for grape ripening is ideal, and for the health of the vine is ideal, because they get a chance to reprieve at night and kind of recoup from the hot days. And so we're able to maintain acidity but still get to the ripeness levels that we want. And for us, and I'm sure we'll get into it here in a little bit, but Merlot is a big grape variety for us and what we produce here at Sullivan Rutherford Estate. And, you know, going down to the kind of the base of Atlas Peak is prime Merlot territory, and really the vineyard that we developed out there was specifically for Merlot. And then we also purchased a property up in Santa Elena, just below, so really the northern part of Santa Elena, below the Santa Elena Hospital off Crystal Springs Road. There's a little valley that winds through there, and there was a 8.5 acre planted established Cabernet Sauvignon vineyard owned by Joe Crescioni. And he planted that back in 2001. Tony Soder helped him establish that vineyard, and Mike Wolf, who happens to be our vineyard manager, has managed that vineyard for 20 plus years. And so really it was an opportunity that came about, kind of going to this, if you can find a vineyard up in the hills or established and has a reputation, those are hard to come by. And if you have an opportunity, you got to jump on it. So we did. And what's cool about that is where we have kind of the white rhyolitic volcanic ash down off our Soda Canyon property, you know, on the up north in that part area, it's also volcanic, but it's the red soils, iron rich, lots of obsidian. And obviously being north in the valley, it's a little bit warmer up there. So really conducive to Cabernet. But in a way, I think that's different than Rutherford. That site where you get the ripeness, you still get freshness because of the red soils and the iron. You still kind of get this sense of leanness. It's not as broad and over the top that you might get in the warmer climates. It still retains some of that freshness, that focus, and so it's just a very unique site.
I want to talk about Merlot, being that from, you know, the damage that sideways left, much maligned grape, but a fabulous grape when it's done right.
Sure.
It is tantalizing.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful blending grape as well, especially if you're doing a classic Bordeaux varietal. Is that the dominating grape you make here, or is it Cabernet, or...?
No, so Cabernet is still what we have predominantly planted across all three properties. But for us, Merlot, there's a historical kind of aspect to Merlot here at Sullivan. Jim Sullivan, when he purchased the property in the late 70s and planted really in 1978, you know, at that time, Napa, I think, was still kind of figuring out what grows best and where. The Cabernet craze hadn't really taken off at that point. So we had Zinfandel, Merlot, Cabernet, Chenin Blanc, Chardonnay planted all across the property. And what he found was that, obviously, the Bordeaux varieties did well, but Merlot specifically was outstanding here. And he kind of leaned into that and really kind of took, so he was still making Cabernet, but really focused on the Merlot. And really, Jim Sullivan, his style, it's funny, the original phone number here is 1-800-BIG-REDS. And so he liked big extracted wines, and he approached that with his Merlot and made some very age-worthy wines. And I believe it was the 92 Wine Spectator put his Merlot in the top 100, and that was the first time that a Napa Valley Merlot had cracked that list. So really kind of put Jim and Sullivan on the map as far as a Merlot producer. And then you have the 80s and 90s come and go, and Cabernet just went crazy, as it should, because it grows phenomenally here and makes some of the best wines in the world. But unfortunately for other grape varieties, it's a problem, because all the what we consider the best soils, so the soils that are the most well drained, that are more conducive to producing really high quality fruit, obviously got replanted, if they weren't already, to Cabernet Sauvignon. And within a property, of the 22 acres we have planted here, not 100% of it is ideal, right? And so, especially being on the valley floor, depending on where you are, there can be a heavy influence of clay, which isn't great from a quality perspective, because it retains water, it's a little bit cooler, it causes a lot of vigor, so the vines are very happy, they produce a lot of fruit, and just you in general make more or less concentrated wines. And so kind of by default, after all the Cabernet takes up your best soils, what do you do with kind of the inferior soils? And so you plant Merlot, or you plant Sauvignon Blanc or Chardonnay or whatever it may be, so that acreage is producing, but you as a winemaker, an owner, or a proprietor in this business understand that those blocks aren't necessarily your best blocks. And so given that, Merlot has kind of taken a back seat over the last 30 years to Cabernet Sauvignon, and winemakers understanding that, I can be the best winemaker in the world, but if I have low quality fruit, no matter what I do, I can't make an exceptional wine. I can make a good wine, an okay wine, I can't make an exceptional wine. So winemakers understood that, and they realized, okay, we've got these really extracted, structured Cabernet Sauvignons. How do we tone that down a little bit? Because again, I think the American consumer wants something that's a little bit more approachable. We're impatient people. We don't want to wait 20 years for a wine to kind of resolve and get into that zone that is acceptable. And so how do you manage that? Well, you take some Merlot that you didn't give a lot of attention to, that you didn't push too hard in the fermenters, that you made in kind of a simple style that's approachable, and you add a little bit of that into the Cabernet to tone it down, to round it out, and there you have it. And that has kind of been the story of Merlot for the last 30 years, and it hasn't been taken seriously. And I think Jim Sullivan recognized that he was onto something. The Sullivans sold the property in 2018 to a small family out of Mexico City, led by Juan Pablo Torres Padilla. He's the managing general partner that's on site and really leading the direction of Sullivan today. And he spent half his life in France, in Paris, and went to school and spent a lot of time in Bordeaux and Burgundy, and really had an opportunity to experience some of the best wines in the world. And as it turns out, Merlot, especially in Bordeaux, is driving that. Like, literally, the most expensive wines in the world are Merlot-driven, if not, 100% Merlot. And so he had always had this affinity to Merlot and the potential that it had. And so when he and his family came out to the Napa Valley looking for a property and a winery to acquire, and they came across the Sullivans and learning about the history with Jim and Merlot and how well it did here, he saw an opportunity, because nobody was, and I would say for the most part, nobody really is thinking of Merlot in the same class that you would think of Napa Valley Cabernet.
Certainly not in this valley, yeah.
absolutely not. And so for him to come in and kind of have that different perspective and see an opportunity there and recognize that if you kind of stand back on the global stage, like Merlot is taken very seriously. And so why not do that here, especially with the history that we have? And so when he bought the property in 2018, you know, that was kind of his mission. And so, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we acquired the property down in Soda Canyon, so the base of Atlas Peak, and that was it hadn't been planted. It was fallow, 12 acres, which is kind of unbelievable because you have Silver Oak and Roy Estates basically surrounding the entire property, and to have 12 acres of untouched soil, it was a dream come true. And that we purchased specifically for Merlot, and so we've got 8.5 acres down there. 80% of it we have planted to Merlot. But then coming back to the Rutherford property and historically how well it's done here, and even before the ownership change, I was making Merlot off of this property, and really in their due diligence realized not only do we love Merlot and see an opportunity, but Jeff and the Sullivan property are doing it at a level that we haven't seen coming out of Napa. So when they bought the property, we did a replant here on the estate where we took out almost 9 acres of Cabernet Sauvignon, and we went back in 50-50, so half Cab, half Merlot.
Great.
Yeah.
But smart, you knew what you were doing.
Well, and so, you know, our whole philosophy is we're a state. We are the estate model, and in order to be a state model, you have to have either ownership or complete control from vine to bottle, and not relying on contracts or sourcing fruit. And so in order for us to maintain that model and have complete control to ensure that the quality of the grapes and therefore the wine are at the highest, we need to own that. And so, yes, we took a little bit of a risk from a business standpoint, replanting some of the best Cabernet soils to Merlot, because as we know, you can get 3 times as much on the bulk market for Cabernet grapes than Merlot. And heaven forbid if ownership decided to sell one day, you know, having Merlot planted in Cab soil kind of devalues the property. But this is a legacy project. This is something that the family has expressed that this is a long-term project.
Sure.
And I think planting this property to Merlot is just, you know, is the confidence that I needed that they are truly invested in this. Okay. And we are going to do it correctly, and we're going to do something that nobody else is doing. And so, you know, of the 22 acres, now we have close to 8 acres planted to Merlot here on the estate. And we've been having conversations as a production team and ownership group of, okay, well, do we take that even further in the future? And do we take some more Cabernet out to plant some Merlot?
Yes.
And again, I might be getting ahead of myself, but those are the conversations we're having. And again, we take Merlot as seriously as we take Cabernet Sauvignon. I mean, we've line priced them exactly the same, which nobody else is doing here in the Valley. And I can't say nobody, there are a few people, but in general, people, even if they think they have a great Merlot, is not pricing it the same as the great Cabernet. And again, I think the market dictates a lot of that. I think being a little bit uncomfortable in that space dictates that. But for us, we're taking it seriously. And if we are saying that we are really going in on Merlot and championing Merlot, then we have to also price it the same, give it the same attention in the vineyard, give it the same attention in the winery, and really try to make, you know, the best possible Merlot we can.
Yeah. Very good. Good answer. New question for me that I've enjoyed asking winemakers. I was reading a book about wineries basically south of San Jose down to really all the way down to the very end of California and even into Mexico. And a common reference was always to French wines. And we do that, and I get that. I mean, I know why, because where it comes from. But does that occasionally take away from us as American wines?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I think that we have such a unique, I mean, California in itself is nowhere else in the world you're going to find
literally
an area like this, as far as, you know, especially for agriculture and just the opportunity across all ranges here, depending on what you want to grow, you can grow it and do it well. So I think, there might be a perception, you know, outside of this area of, okay, Bordeaux, you know, Italy, those are the standards, and you know, maybe they should be because they've been doing it for thousands of years, and those, you know, they are places that really establish, you know, wine and what it is and how it fits in within the culture. But I think, you know, whether it's Napa, you know, Paso Robles, you know, Sonoma, you go to Chile, Australia, wherever, I mean, there's opportunity to grow grapes and do it at a high level. And I think that, you know, Bordeaux or Italy as a baseline is fine. But again, we get to ripeness levels here that generally you don't get to in Bordeaux. And if you were to give some truth serum to a Bordeaux winemaker, they would want a little bit more ripeness, right?
Good luck trying to do that.
Yeah, exactly. And it's fine. And stylistically, that's what it is. And, you know, Napa, California, we're different in that sense. Yeah. And we do get ripeness. And I like to say, you know, specifically here in Napa and really anywhere in California, but you stylistically, you can do whatever you want, right? If you want to make a more traditional old world type of wine, you can just pick a little bit earlier, or you can choose a site that allows that style. If you want ripeness and you want to go over the top and no tannin and high alcohol and something that is, you know, instantly gratifying, you could go that route too, and you can go anywhere in the middle. And so I think there, here in California, there's just an opportunity to express yourself as a winemaker, as a brand, and really, you know, do what you want and make a wine that you want to make year in and year out. And you know, California just provides that consistency. Whereas in Bordeaux, you've got the great vintages, which happen to be slightly warmer vintages because they get a little bit more ripeness along with the structure. And so, I mean, I think the old world is the standard, but then there's offshoots of that. And, you know, being in California, you can really do whatever you want.
Maybe crazier weather over there, too. Do you do a side project at all of your own these days now that you're here? Is it just a little fun thing at all, or?
No, I mean, obviously with my wines here for Sullivan Rutherford Estate, you know, I'm always every year trying to, you know, improve upon what I've done, you know, the year before or historically, and always trying to incrementally, you know, make the wines better. So there are things I do, you know, experimentation wise within the winery to try to achieve that 1%, you know, increase in quality every year. But as far as personally side projects, no, I don't have time. I mean, Between managing the property here, you know, like I said, I've got 11-year-old twin girls, you know, we've got all kinds of things going on with them. And so it's life is moving fast. Let's just put it like that. So I don't really have time for too many side projects.
That's fair. Fair enough. For our listeners who'd like to come here, I'm assuming this is, of course, a by reservation experience.
It is, yep.
Is it something you can just do online or just call the winery, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so for anybody that wants to visit, we are open 7 days a week, minus a couple of holidays. It is reservation or by appointment only, so you give us a call or you can go online and schedule the appointment in advance. I would say, we've got a, you know, for us here at the estate, we try to limit the reservations on a daily basis because, again, we're trying to create an exceptional, one-of-a-kind of experience. And so we, you know, having less people here during those experiences is only better. I will say, though, we are starting kind of on this Merlot theme, a new program called Merlot Mastery, where we are basically taking our J.O. Sullivan Founders Reserve Merlot, which is our best Merlot in that vintage, and we are doing two tastings within that experience. We are doing a blind tasting first, where we take our Merlot and we take two other Merlot-driven wines. And for us, we have decided to go outside of this area and into Bordeaux and into Italy, where we take brands that are considered the best, that have been around for a while, that are really the industry standard, you know, globally, as far as Merlot producers go, and we do a blind tasting with two of those wines and ours. Our goal isn't to say, look, our wine is better or these wines are better than this. Our goal is simply to educate and show that if taken seriously and done correctly, from winemaking to vineyard management to everything in between, that we can make, and we meaning here at Sullivan Rutherford Estate, specifically in Napa, can make Merlot on the world class stage, if you will, and compete on that level as far as quality goes. And so again, it's not to get a gotcha and aha, it's simply to open people's minds, because I think we can sit here as a company and as a winemaker and say we make one of the best Merlots coming out of the Napa Valley, but that's easy to say. And so for us, we want to not just talk the talk, but show that stylistically we can make wines that are up there and rival some of the best in the world. And then after that, we do a vertical tasting of three vintages of the Merlot as well.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah.
Cool idea. And of course, for our listeners who would like to learn more about you online, what is your website?
Yeah, so you can reach us at sullivanwine.com. You can purchase wines off there, set up your reservation, and just gather any information you'd like.
Great. Well, on this wonderfully rainy day, and hopefully the rest of the week will clear up a little bit, I say thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it, Ray. Thank you.
Learn more by visiting sullivanwine.com.
Thanks for listening. Subscribe to the podcast at lifebetweenthevines.com or sign up to our YouTube channel. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Life Between the Vines comes to you from Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our web geek is Dan Geeshan. Original music by Ray Pfister. Copyright 2024.